Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today we've got some hot local, national, and international news to share, as well as some of our favorite Best of East County episodes through the years. While some folks were celebrating the holiday weekend with family and friends, others took to the streets in more than 100 cities, including here in San Diego, for a tax day protest asking President Donald Trump to release his taxes, and we'll have details on today's show. This Thursday, there's a town hall forum in El Cajon featuring seven candidates who are running for Congressman Duncan Hunter's seat in the 50th Congressional District. This is one of the most diverse and qualified slates of candidates we've seen running in this race in recent memory, so stay tuned to learn more about them. Leaders in the travel and tourism industry, along with economic experts, are speaking out to warn that President Trump's travel ban and anti-immigration policies stand to cost the U.S. trillions of dollars in lost tourism. And San Diego could be the most hard-hit city in the nation from the Trump team's policies. Hear why on today's show. Last week, the U.S. military dropped a weapon known as the mother of all bombs on Afghanistan. Hear what Afghan leaders, as well as the Pentagon, have to say about the outcome of that mission on today's show. Next up, we'll share some good news for pets in county animal shelters locally, thanks to a Good Samaritan who's made a very generous donation. We also have some tragic news about an El Cajon refugee family who fled violence and civil war in Syria to create a better future for their only son, only to lose him in an unforeseen tragedy here in San Diego. Plus, hear what you can do to help the boys' sisters and parents who have all suffered more than their share of hardships. The weather is warming up, and that means snakes are active, too. Sightings of rattlers are up this year over last, so stay tuned to hear what you should know to protect yourself, your children, and your dogs from rattlesnakes at home or on the trail. Then on our agricultural report, we'll have news about a major new effort by the county teaming up with local growers to help eradicate a pest that threatens citrus crops in our region and across Southern California. On the second half of our show, after this holiday weekend, we'll be sharing some of our favorite Best of East County segments, including an Animal Tales interview with Roy Toft. He's a Ramona photographer, famous for his travels with National Geographic, and he'll tell you about his adventures photographing tigers and other exotic wildlife. Then we'll take you on the road to the Desert View Tower in Hakumba Hot Springs, one of our region's quirkiest and most iconic roadside landmarks. On Green Scene, learn about progress being made in the fight to prevent San Onofre from becoming a permanent nuclear waste dump just inches above the high tide mark along our ocean. We'll also have an update on missing El Cajon man Elijah Bear Diaz, whose case will be featured on a national TV show this week in hopes of bringing Bear home. Plus, learn about a recall that's been issued for certain Ford pickup trucks that are surprising their owners by rolling away. So stay tuned for all of these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. Demonstrators in over 100 cities held tax day protests on April 15th, calling on President Donald Trump to release his income tax returns. San Diego event organizers estimate that several thousand took to the streets locally, also urging Congress to subpoena Trump's tax returns. The marchers carried signs with messages such as, "What's he hiding?" and "Don the Con," a reference to Trump reneging on his campaign promise to release his tax returns if elected. Trump's motorcade in Mar-a-Lago, Florida, was rerouted to avoid crowds of protesters there. Trump responded to the protest with a tweet, stating defiantly, "Someone should look into who paid for the small organized rallies yesterday. The election is over," he tweeted. In refusing to release his taxes, Trump goes against decades of precedent, since every president has released tax returns dating back to Richard Nixon in 1973. Trump has said he isn't releasing his returns because he is under audit by the Internal Revenue Service, or IRS. But the IRS has clearly stated that audits don't prevent the release of tax returns. Citizens for Ethics in Government, or CREW, states, releasing his tax returns could show where Trump's business dealings and potential conflicts of interests lie. CREW has filed a lawsuit alleging that Trump has violated the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution by illegally receiving payments from foreign governments, an allegation that releasing his tax returns could prove or disprove. A statement on CREW's website concludes, to begin to address concerns regarding his administration's and his business relationships with foreign governments, including Russia, Donald Trump must release his tax returns. And what better day than on Tax Day? Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
With Republican Congressman Duncan Hunter under criminal investigation by the Justice Department, seven Democratic candidates vying for his seat will be speaking out in a town hall forum hosted by the East County Democratic Club. The event will be held this Thursday, April 20th at 1150 East Broadway. That's the Pacific Southwest Association of Realtors building in El Cajon. A social hour and potluck will be held at 6 p.m. with a program starting at 7 to 9 p.m. Candidates include several veterans and multiple individuals with medical backgrounds. The diverse field includes a rancher, a nurse, a realtor, a former U.S. Labor Department official, an ex-Navy SEAL, two former military medics, an organic farmer environmental consultant, a school board member, an economist, and a rural planning group member. RSVPs are requested by calling Bonnie Price at 619-714-6811. Each candidate will provide an opening statement followed by questions from club leaders, and then written questions from the audience. Here is some information on the seven candidates. Pierre Beauregard, known as Pete, is a Ramona rancher, ex-Navy medic, founder of a community medical clinic, and former rodeo bull rider. He became an activist in the Occupy movement after the housing market collapse to seek reforms to protect homeowners from predatory lenders. Josh Butner is a retired Navy Lieutenant Commander and Gulf War veteran. He's currently an elected member of the Hamul Dulzura School Board. His military experience including service as a Navy SEAL, SEAL instructor, and medical corpsman. He also runs a military division of Aqualung, an underwater dive company that traces its origins to Jacques Cousteau. Amar Campa Najir served as public affairs officer for the U.S. Department of Labor in the Obama administration. A native San Diegan of Hispanic and Arab descent, he has served as director of communications and marketing for the U.S. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, was a White House intern, and worked with nonprofits and his church on issues ranging from helping deported veterans to supporting working people. Gloria Chadwick is an elected member of the Grossmont Healthcare District Board of Directors, overseeing Grossmont Hospital. She is a retired registered nurse who worked for many years at the Veterans Administration Hospital in San Diego. She is also a talented and internationally acclaimed wildlife artist who speaks on conservation issues. Hannah Gebb is an elected member of the Hamul Dulzura Community Planning Group. She is also an environmental teacher, consultant, and researcher, as well as an organic farmer who serves on the board of the County Farm Bureau. She has worked as a consultant for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and as program assistant for the Oglala Sioux Tribal Government. Glenn Jensen was born and raised in La Mesa, graduated from Helix High School, then received his economics degree from UCSD. He says he has a history of political activism, fighting for causes including free public education, the environment, equality, and women's rights. He has also been a lobbyist for consumer access on telecommunications issues and supports net neutrality. Patrick Malloy is a realtor who says he knows the neighborhoods, schools, and roads in the 50th Congressional District. He previously ran against Congressman Hunter in the 2016 race. Malloy says he's running to repair a do-nothing Congress and rid the district of corruption. The U.S. Justice Department's investigation of Representative Hunter is looking into whether his spending of over $60,000 in campaign funds for personal reasons, including taxpayer-funded matching funds, constitutes criminal violations. Two prior investigations into similar conduct by members of Congress resulted in convictions and prison time. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
the U.S. is poised to lose $7.4 billion in lost tourism this year and $10.9 billion next year due to President Donald Trump's travel ban and other policies making travelers feel unwelcome in the U.S., Tourism Economics estimates. Those impacts are already occurring, and San Diego could be the most hard-hit city in the nation when coupled with other Trump policies targeting immigrants, Forbes predicts. The Washington Post, in an April 14th article, reports that major hotel chains, airlines, and travel booking services are reporting huge drop-offs in travel bookings to the U.S. from every country in the world except Russia. Marriott reports a 30% drop in bookings from the Middle East and a 15% fall in bookings from Mexico. Hopper, a travel booking app, says demand for flights to the U.S., even from allies such as Ireland and New Zealand, are down 35%. Border cities are also hard hit, losing crossing traffic at the border on the ground from people who formerly came to the U.S. to shop or visit. Forbes reported in January that Trump's mass deportation of immigrants, including undocumented workers, would put San Diego, quote, directly in the crosshairs, unquote, of the president. Forbes adds, San Diego could well be ground zero, from construction to tourism to hospitality. Industry and labor in the city is fueled in large measure by a group of people who Trump derides as criminals, rapists, or bad hombres, Forbes reported. The esteemed business publication concluded, San Diego's economy would undoubtedly suffer a massive sudden blow when Trump begins deporting mass numbers of undocumented immigrant workers, as he has pledged to do. Now, Forbes spoke with both employees and major employers in San Diego in fields ranging from agriculture to hotels to construction, under condition of anonymity. Forbes found workers fearful of being deported and employers who admitted that a large portion of their workers are likely undocumented people with forged paperwork. Statewide, an estimated 6.3% of California's population is undocumented, so widespread deportations could have a ripple effect across the state. That's one reason why many legislators in California are touting sanctuary city or state status to try and shield undocumented workers and their families from being forced to leave the U.S. And even Republican Mayor of San Diego, Kevin Faulkner, has been outspoken in his support of cross-border relations. Nationwide, the Center for American Progress conducted a study which predicted that if Trump were to carry out his campaign promise to remove all 11 million undocumented immigrants, an admittedly daunting task, that would reduce the nation's gross domestic product by a whopping $4.7 trillion a year. And that doesn't count the billions or trillions it would likely cost to deport so many people, including legal proceedings and more. At a time when the president is wielding a budget axe to slash or eliminate many programs popular with the public, from Social Security to public education, healthcare, arts, and public television, the consequences of the president's travel ban and deportation policies may ultimately harm many voters who supported him in 2016. Five major polls conducted this month have found that the majority of Americans surveyed now disapprove of Trump's actions as president, putting his supporters in the minority. Dissent that could deepen as the huge economic impacts of his anti-immigrant and anti-tourism policies hit home in cities and towns across the nation, especially border cities such as San Diego that depend on cross-border traffic, foreign workers, and tourism dollars to thrive. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
The United States on Thursday dropped the largest non-nuclear bomb ever deployed to destroy caves used by ISIS fighters in the Achin area of Afghanistan, the Pentagon confirms. Some Afghan officials estimate that as many as 94 ISIS fighters and four commanders may have been killed, with no civilian deaths reported, according to NBC News. The weapon is officially called a Massive Ordnance Air Blast Bomb, or MOAB, but unofficially it's been dubbed the Mother of All Bombs. It created a mushroom-like cloud visible 20 miles away, NBC reports. Bill Roggio from Foundation for Defense of Democracies told the Air Force Times, "What it does is basically suck out all of the oxygen and lights the air on fire." He said the bomb provides a means of getting into areas that conventional bombs can't reach. The massive bomb weighs 21,000 pounds and delivers an 18,700-pound warhead. The bomb is 30 feet long with a diameter of over 40 inches, capable of blasting a hole with a radius of 150 meters, according to the Pentagon website. Developed to be more accurate than the unguided daisy cutter bombs used in Vietnam, the MOAB was dropped out of a plane with a parachute. It's not the largest bomb in the world. However, AFP reports that the Russians claim to have developed what they call the father of all bombs, with the ability to blast a radius twice the size of the bomb that the U.S. dropped in Afghanistan. The mother of all bombs was developed in 2003 when a video showing a test was released to pressure Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein to stop fighting coalition forces. The bomb was never used during that war. It arrived in Afghanistan in January and was deployed on order of General Nicholson, who did not request nor require approval of President Donald Trump, NBC reports. Afghan officials first said that 36 ISIS fighters died in the blast, but on Saturday, AFP reports that Aichen District Governor Ismail Shinwari says at least 92 fighters from Daesh, another name for ISIS or the Islamic State, were killed in the bombing, with no military or civilian casualties. However, an elderly man living near the bomb site has said that the loud noise from the bomb has caused his infant granddaughter to experience hearing loss, AFP reports. Officials indicate the dead include the brother of the late Islamic State leader Hafiz Saeed, who was killed in a U.S. airstrike last year. Afghan's current president, Ashraf Ghani, expressed support for the bombing that he said was designed to support efforts of the Afghan National Security Forces and U.S. forces trying to clear landmines in the area that posed danger to troops. But former Afghan President Hamid Karzai tweeted condemnation of the strike, contending that his country is being used as a testing ground. President Trump called the mission very, very successful. The Air Force has said that the bomb cost approximately $170,000 and was produced by the Air Force itself, so there was no procurement cost from an outside contractor, Business Insider reports. Ostensibly, the bomb was dropped to help stop ISIS from gaining strength in a region where the U.S. has long been waging war against Taliban forces, and most Afghan people fear ISIS even more than the Taliban, according to former U.S. Army intelligence officer Andrew Peake in an analysis published in the New York Daily News. Peake suggests the real target, however, may have been North Korea, specifically sending a warning to North Korea's dictator with a show of military firepower. Peak suggests Korean dictator Kim Jong-un has recently conducted tests of nuclear weapons in violation of a United Nations agreement, leading Peak to speculate that a showdown between the U.S. and North Korea may be looming. Since taking office, Trump has said he would respond militarily if North Korea launches further nuclear tests. He announced deployment of an armada, including the San Diego-based Carl Vinson, a nuclear-armed ship, to the waters off North Korea. As the rhetoric intensifies, even China has reportedly urged Kim Jong-un to exercise restraint, the United Kingdom's independent newspaper reports. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
A Good Samaritan has made an anonymous donation of over $100,000 to the County Animal Services Spirit Fund. That's enough to help dozens of sick and injured animals get the specialized care that they need to lead healthy lives in new adoptive homes. County supervisors approved acceptance of the donation during a board meeting on Tuesday. That brings the Spirit Medical Trust Fund's total to nearly $220,000. County Animal Services Director Daniel D'Souza says, thanks to the compassion and generosity of not only this donor, but everyone else that has donated to the Spirit Fund, we'll be able to continue to provide veterinary care above and beyond the capabilities of our shelters, giving more animals the chance at a forever home. The Spirit Fund began nearly a decade ago, back in July 2008, after a puppy was found savagely beaten near the Mexican border. Despite her many injuries, she was still loving and hadn't lost her spirit. As a result, the dog was named Spirit. Her plight gained national attention. Donations poured in to help her with her medical care. So much came in that the department started the Spirit Medical Trust Fund to help other animals in need of expensive treatment. Since that time, hundreds of animals in need have received medical attention. If you would like to contribute to the Spirit Fund, you can visit the San Diego County Department of Animal Services webpage and click on the Spirit Fund link. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ Radio, this is Rebecca Williamson.
A Syrian refugee family in El Cajon who fled war-torn Syria to give their only son a brighter future is now grieving over his loss. On his first trip ever to a beach, 17-year-old Mohammed Al-Mustafa was pulled under by a rip current last week off Mission Beach and has not been found. The teen attended El Cajon High School and wanted to join the U.S. military, CBS 8 reported. He sent a message to his father from the beach where he'd gone with friends shortly before he went wading into waist-deep surf. The San Diego Union-Tribune reports that a lifeguard spotted one of Mohammed's friends struggling in the riptide and rescued him, but rescuers were unable to find Mohammed, who could not swim. A two-day search included lifeguards, a police helicopter, and Coast Guard ships with sonar. St. Thomas More Catholic Church in Oceanside has been helping the Al-Mustafa family and other Syrian refugees in our area. The church posted a message expressing deep sadness over the tragedy and said that Mohammed is presumed by authorities to have drowned. The family has posted photos of their son around San Diego in the unlikely event that he may have been washed ashore, panicked, and become lost somewhere in the city. The church parish had previously adopted Mohammed's family, with church members donating furniture, appliances, gift cards, cash, and a sewing machine, since Mohammed's mother has worked as a seamstress. His father, an accountant, is still seeking work to support his remaining family. One church parishioner is offering help with education for the family's two oldest daughters, who hope to enter college this fall. The family has four daughters, ranging in age from 5 to 21. Mohammed's family arrived here in January and has also been helped by Catholic Charities. Refugee families are given minimal government support, only a one-time payment of $1,850, and they are expected to be self-sufficient within 90 days of arrival. Mohammed's mother has been inconsolable over loss of her only son, the church messages states. The teen's father, Hussein Al-Mustafa, spoke to the San Diego Union-Tribune through a translator. He said his family witnessed bombings and violence in Aleppo, Syria, where friends and neighbors were killed. The family escaped Syria in 2014 and traveled first to Turkey, where they registered as refugees. Mohammed's father said his son was robbed of a childhood in war-torn Syria, so the family came to America in hopes of a better future for their son in the United States. But instead, his life was apparently lost not to the violence of war, but to the beautiful but deadly waves in the Pacific Ocean. You can help the Al-Mustafa family through St. Thomas More Catholic Church's website. The church has posted the biblical message of Christ on its website, "I was a refugee and you welcomed me," to encourage generosity toward refugees seeking what so many of our ancestors sought in generations past, freedom from oppression and the ability to pursue the American dream. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
It's springtime, and it seems everyone is enjoying the sunshine, even snakes. Since January, County Animal Services has responded to 276 rattlesnake calls. That's about 50 more than the same time period last year. County Animal Services Director Dan DeSouza says snake sightings jump during warmer weather, but thanks to San Diego's moderate climate, we can receive calls any time of year. Basically, every season is rattlesnake season, and they can show up anywhere from the coast to the desert, he adds. Case in point, recently a Mira Mesa homeowner called Animal Services to remove a 4-foot-long red diamond rattler, the largest such snake that the officer dispatched to remove it had seen. If you see a rattlesnake on your property, keep a safe distance, and you can call Animal Control Services at 619-236-2341 or call the Animal Control Agency for your city. To minimize your chance of being bitten by a rattlesnake, here are some tips. If hiking, wear sturdy hiking boots. Stay on the trail and avoid tall grass or brush where snakes can hide. Consider carrying a walking stick, since if you do stumble onto a snake, it may strike the stick instead of your leg. Never reach into areas you can't see, since snakes may lurk in wood piles or atop sunny rock ledges. Keep your dog on a leash while hiking. Rattlesnake vaccines are also available to protect your dog. If you do see a snake, freeze and wait for it to move away. A rattling sound means the snake is ready to strike, so it's best to calmly back away. If you live on a canyon or in an area where rattlesnakes have been found, always check your yard first before letting children out to play. It's also wise to eliminate rodents on your property that are prey which attract snakes. If you are bitten, it's important to seek medical help immediately by calling 911. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
How you gonna keep 'em down on the farm after they seen Harry?
This is Gene Carpenter with East County Magazine's Agricultural Report. San Diego supervisors have approved formation of a special district to combat the Asian citrus psyllid, an agricultural pest that threatens our county's $126 million citrus crop. Supervisors took the action in response to a petition signed by commercial growers in Borrego Springs, San Pasqual Valley, and Palma Valley. The growers, who own 80% of the citrus acreage in our region, asked the county to create the district to provide legal authority for working to eradicate the Asian citrus psyllid. The pest can transmit Wanglongbing, also known as citrus greening disease. The disease kills citrus trees and has wiped out groves in other parts of the world. In Florida alone, the disease caused an estimated loss of $3.6 billion to the economy. Our county is currently under quarantine because the pest has been found here, but so far, no cases of the dreaded citrus greening disease have been found. But the bacteria responsible for the disease has been found in parts of Los Angeles County. Supervisors approved the special district on the consent calendar. On May 3rd, any protests to the actions will be heard. The district would be funded by the agricultural landowners and would devise a plan for combating the pest, a budget, and ways to assess the program's success. The Asian citrus psyllid is small, measuring only about 1/8 of an inch in length. It's brown and produces a white, waxy substance that leaves a soot-like black mold on leaves. Leaves become twisted and yellowed, while fruit on infected trees can stay green and be deformed. Ants have a symbiotic relationship that protects the psyllids, so citrus tree owners are advised to keep ants off the citrus trees. For information on Asian citrus psyllids and how to protect your citrus trees, you can visit www.californiacitrusthreat.org.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
Welcome. This is Mimi Pollack, host of East County Magazine's Animal Tales. Welcome to Animal Tales. This is Mimi Pollack. I am here today with Ramona wildlife photographer Roy Tuft. Not only is he a renowned photographer with pictures appearing in National Geographic magazine, he also offers guided tours to Africa, Costa Rica, and Alaska. Tuft got his degree as a wildlife biologist, so the focus of these tours is showing you how to photograph indigenous wildlife while having adventures in the wild. Welcome, Roy.
Thanks for having me, Mimi. Happy to be here.
How did you get into wildlife photography?
Well, I was the crazy kid in Poway with the garage full of snakes, right? So right away, everybody knew I loved animals. And so I grew up loving animals, getting out in our local chaparral and watching the hawks and catching snakes and enjoying that. Went on to get a wildlife degree from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo in Northern California and got my first camera as I graduated from college and started taking pictures of what I loved.
What type of camera was it?
It was a Canon AE-1, which was kind of a classic old film camera.
And so the camera inspired you to start taking pictures and combining both the wildlife degree along with the photography.
Yeah, I mean, it's always the animals that were the major interest, and the photography is kind of a stimulus to get you out there, right? And it keeps you out there longer. So it's just kind of a natural thing to want to enjoy your subjects more. You can take images of them and enjoy them when you're back home.
And besides Costa Rica and Alaska, what countries have you been to in Africa, and what other countries have you been to in the world where you've done wildlife photography?
Wow, good question. I've been to, I should count the number of countries I've been to, but in the last 30 years of doing wildlife photography, I've been pretty much all over the world, from Antarctica to Japan and Indonesia and Australia, New Zealand, most of the countries in Africa and Central and South America. So yeah, I guess it'd be easier to say very few places I haven't been at this point.
And after college, how did you move into becoming more of a professional wildlife photographer?
Well, right after college, I started working at the Wild Animal Park here in San Diego. I guess now it's called the Zufari Park, which is always hard for me to remember. And I was doing the bird show there, and it's kind of a, I think anybody that's been in San Diego for a while knows that bird show. It's been there for 30 years, so I was happy that they asked me to join them there at the bird show. And being at the Wild Animal Park every day, doing my job at the bird show, of course, I'm surrounded by beautiful wildlife, even though it's, you know, it's not really wild, but it gave me an opportunity to get out during breaks and lunch hours with my camera and start taking imagery and work on it and get better at it. And so that really got me going into wildlife photography.
And how did you get connected to National Geographic magazine?
One of my last years working at the park, we had a National Geographic photographer come to the park doing a story on new zoos. And his name was Michael Nick Nichols, really a world-renowned photographer who's done dozens and dozens of stories for National Geographic. Well, everybody at the park knew I was into photography pretty heavily at that point. So they asked Nick if he needed an assistant, and I helped him on that new zoos project. So that kind of got me, you know, a little bit in working with National Geographic. And a couple years later, I went and did a 2-year project with Nick on tigers that we spent 2 years photographing wild tigers. And that was kind of the start of my career and a wonderful, you know, mentorship for me to be working with such a well-known and terrific photographer as Nick.
Tell me more about those 2 years photographing tigers. For example, what exactly did you do while you were there? How did you help Nick? And do you have any memorable moment or story that you can tell us from those years?
Sure. Yeah. So we are working in India, which has the largest population of tigers. And a big part of the story, of course, is doing a natural history portion of the project. So we spent over 2 years photographing a female tiger raising cubs. We basically go out every day at 4:30 in the morning on elephant back, because that's the easiest and most accessible way to be close to tigers, is to be on top of an animal that they're not really that nervous about. 7 days a week for 3 months per trip to India. So we did 3 of those for the natural history portion. And we were photographing tigers, and we'd spend about 10 hours a day in the field and only see tigers about every 5 days on average. So it was a lot of time in the field for very little, you know, return, but it was definitely worth it.
But didn't you also do some groundbreaking work with remote cameras?
Yes, Nick was just really pushing the limits with remote cameras in the field, and tigers being a difficult animal to photograph in person and at close range. He set up 7 remote cameras in the jungle with my help. And my main job was to keep those remote cameras running 24/7. A remote camera, if you don't know, is a system where there's an infrared beam, and the animal basically breaks that beam and takes his own picture. And that allowed us to take wide-angle, very intimate shots of tigers that have never been done before. And that was one of our main ways of getting that kind of unique imagery of tigers while we were there.
That sounds very interesting. I imagine you must have gotten some incredible photographs with the remote cameras. Is there any one particular picture that you remember that comes to mind? Or
yeah, actually, if just for the listeners at home, if you have kind of that stack of National Geographic magazines on your library wall, it's 1997 December is the cover issue, and one of the pictures in there was a 50-page story, so it was a huge Nat Geo article. One of the pictures I placed a camera on a vertical dry waterfall, so it's a rock wall, and we had seen a male tiger jump that chasm in the where the water would be running if it was actually wet, and to get to another water source. And so we put this camera, set it up so he's jumping right into a 20 millimeter wide lens, which is a very unique perspective. And that camera was there for 3 months, and we had one picture from that 3 months, and it's in the issue, and it's amazing, you know, a male tiger jumping right into the camera midair. So it's wow. one of those, you know, pictures you'd never get in person. You'd have to kind of use this system of remote cameras, and it's much more common nowadays, but when Nick did it, and we did it for the Tiger Project, it was really revolutionary.
I remember that issue. It was just amazing. Now tell me about a memorable moment.
Another memorable moment with tigers is, as I mentioned earlier, we spent a lot of time in elephants following tigers and photographing them straight and not with a remote camera. Well, at one time, Nick was on one elephant, I was on another elephant, and we have our mahouts, or our drivers, driving the elephants, and we had this one male tiger named Charger that was in this tall grass, and we backed our elephants into the grass to be able to photograph from a perspective down into the grass, and obviously went too close to the tiger as he was feeling pressured. He came up on the back of Nick's elephant, actually jumped onto the rear of the elephant.
Wow.
Which was exciting for everyone, especially the elephants. So the elephants just started spinning and screaming, and we, you know, Nick and I held on for dear life,
and they rotated fast.
Yes, they just spun, you know, just like tornadoes, and just sent the tiger flying, and it was quite an exciting moment. You know, like most things with wildlife photography, when instances like this happen, you know, it's usually because we do something wrong, and it was obviously our fault. We pushed the, you know, we asked the elephants to get too close to the tiger, and he just did what was natural for a tiger, which is get out of here. And of course, he did it in a very traumatic fashion.
That was probably scary and exciting at the same time.
Yeah, certainly.
And then after, when you finished with doing the tiger shoot, what was the next project you worked on?
Well, after the tiger project, I came home and rested for a while because that was a long project. I actually did an assignment for Audubon magazine where I went and photographed ocelots in Texas. And it's another cat, a smaller spotted cat. And a lot of people don't know we have ocelots in the United States.
I didn't know that. Ocelots in Texas. What part of Texas?
Yeah, this was in near Laguna Atascosa. So it's way south Texas. The majority of ocelots are found in Central and South America. So this is just kind of a small population coming up into Texas.
Are they endangered?
They are in danger. There's only about 50 ocelots left in Texas in the United States. And so, yeah, I was also using remote cameras again to photograph this elusive cat.
And then what was your next big shoot after that?
Wow. Next big shoot after that. I did another project for Audubon on a rainforest photography and birds. So that was another cover story for Audubon magazine.
I remember you told me about wolves, that you did something up in Alaska with wolves.
Yeah, you know, right out of college, as I mentioned, I was a wildlife biology major, and right out of college, I did a wolf population study up in Alaska for the summer. It was, you know, merely a three-month project, putting collars on wolves so we could do a population study. So that was my first time in the field with my new camera, so that was a kind of an exciting time for me.
And then also for, I believe it was 3 years, you and your wife opened up a gallery up in Solana Beach on Cedros Avenue, right?
Yeah, we had a beautiful gallery on Cedros in Solana Beach, and it was my wife's idea to kind of show my art to people and be able to have a gallery, and it was fun. We did that and met a lot of local people. It was when we first moved back to San Diego in the early 2000s, you know, we moved back in 2005.
Where did you live before then?
We were up in the Bay Area for about 8 years, up in Half Moon Bay on the coast south of San Francisco.
But you are a local San Diego boy, right? Where did you grow up?
Yeah, I actually grew up in Poway. So we moved to Poway in 1970. Yeah, I grew up here, went to high school here, went off to college in Northern California, and then we moved around a bit and then came back to kind of the motherland here in Ramona in 2005.
What do you like about living in Ramona?
We love the wilderness experience we have in Ramona. You know, we live on big acreage, which you can still find here in the East County, which is great. And so it's peaceful.
How many acres?
We have 40 acres.
Wow.
Yeah, and nice. It's in kind of the big boulder country up there near Mount Woodson, so it's beautiful. Lots of local wildlife. You know, I don't always have to jump on an airplane to get my camera out and photograph wildlife. In fact, this last week, I've spent every morning in a blind photographing our small indigenous fox, our California gray fox, something that actually I've spent no time photographing fox all my years here. They're kind of a tough animal to see. We often see coyotes a lot more, but this is a little bit smaller canid that is more nocturnal, quite a bit more elusive than coyotes. And they're just beautiful. They have a gray color with a cinnamon rust on the chest and their shoulders. Gorgeous, big fluffy tail. And this week I was sitting in a blind photographing a den with five kits, and that's what they call young foxes. So what a great, you know, here I am in my backyard. I got my coffee and I walk across the valley, get in my blind and photograph beautiful foxes right here in San Diego County.
I know. I've seen the pictures. They're amazing. Now, you mentioned to me earlier that you have a teaching credential and you enjoy working with people. And so you mentioned to me that in the year 2000, you started organizing photographic expeditions where you would take people to different countries and teach them how to photograph wildlife. Tell us more about that.
Sure. Yeah, that's a big part of my business now is leading photographic tours or safaris. It's never a better time than now to take photos. You know, the digital era and digital cameras have made it so much more accessible for people. You know, you're not spending a ton of money on film. You're getting instant feedback from these little TV screens. So you can really progress much quicker than the old days with film. And so, you know, people are finding they want to go out instead of going on a typical vacation and going to some beach and sitting on the beach or going golfing, that there's this whole other avenue for vacations. And, you know, you can combine wildlife viewing, traveling, and learning something new and exciting. And that's what I do in these wildlife tours. You know, I bring people to Africa or Brazil or Alaska for bears or Mexico, and Costa Rica is one of my all-time favorite destinations. It's close and you have a rainforest right there. So it's a wonderful way to get people out in the field and, you know, try out a new camera, or if they're already an experienced photographer, it's wonderful to go with a pro that already gives you, taking you to the best spots and the best lodges. And so that's a big part of my business. In fact, this year I'll be in the field 160 days running my photo tours.
For those of you who just tuned in, this is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, East County Magazine. Now, I want to go into more detail about these trips. For example, what countries do you go to in Africa?
My main country I go to in Africa is Botswana, a lovely country. It's just north of South Africa, so it's in the southern part of the continent. And I've been going there. This will be my 14th year leading tours to Botswana, so obviously I love it. It's spectacular wildlife. Most people perhaps have heard of the Okavango Delta, which is a very well-known area. It's a floodplain and a desert that creates this oasis for wildlife. And so that's my main destination. Although I have to say next week, I'm going to Tanzania in East Africa, leading a photo trip there. So a couple different countries in Africa I go to.
Getting back to Botswana, do some people go there because of the books, The Number One Ladies Detective Agency? Do they ever go there and ask you about that? Or?
Yeah, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. I mean, we people who go to Botswana, of course, have read those books because it's such an interesting series and it's based in Botswana. I don't think it's the reason they go, obviously, because it's really the wildlife that brings them there, but it's a nice connection.
Yeah. When people go to Africa, they must think that, you know, they're going to be roughing it. Or why don't you tell us, because I remember you mentioned to me that you want people to know that going to Africa is not going to be roughing it, that it's actually going to be a very pleasant experience in terms of lodging and food and how they take care of you.
Yeah, I mean, I get that a lot, Mimi. I get, you know, isn't it dangerous and aren't you afraid going to Africa? And I think so much of the media reports, they generalize when they're speaking of the entire continent of Africa, when there's, you know, there's epidemics of something going on or a little bit of violence somewhere. It's a huge continent. And, you know, we're going to a place that's very safe. In fact, the most dangerous part of your African safari will be driving to the airport here in Limburg Field. I mean, being in your car, statistically is more dangerous than any other part of the trip. And we're taken care of. It's just really amazing the service level that we get in our trips to Africa, the lodging, the food, the wine. Yeah, everything is 5-star. So there's absolutely no roughing it. You know, I have clients that are kind of wonder what big hiking boots they should buy to bring on my trip. And I have to tell them that, you know, I wear Crocs, the most comfortable light slip-on shoe, because we're in vehicles all day. We're not going on death marches. We're not hiking. We're driving around in wonderful vehicles and viewing this wildlife very close, and photographing it, and then going back for wonderful dinners and wonderful lodging. So it's, you know, it's nothing that you have to worry about roughing it. It's very much a luxury vacation.
I've also heard that the African people themselves are very friendly and very welcoming.
They really are. They are just over the top friendly, just smiles from ear to ear at all times. And so it's a wonderful cultural experience. People that just don't get to travel that much, if it's based on fear, get out there and see some other places around the world, because people are people. And when you go to these communities, they're just so welcoming. And, you know, it's such a joy to see people from around the world and get a different perspective. If you're just always in one location, it's tough to view the world in more than one perspective. So yeah, get out there and travel and see the world and see some beautiful places. That's what I like to do.
Now, what about for the more outdoorsy types, the ones that want to go hiking, the ones that want to have more of an outdoor adventure? What country would you recommend that they take a photographic tour with you? You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
More of an outdoorsy hiking.
Yeah, if you don't want to be in a vehicle the entire time and you want to get out and physically hike and enjoy the environment. I actually have several that do that. Costa Rica is a great one. It's close. It's an easy flight. Within 6 hours, you're in prime rainforest and seeing, you know, 4 species of monkeys and tropical birds, toucans and parrots. It's really mind-boggling, you know, in this day and age. You can just get away for 6-8 hours and you're in this amazing tropical environment. So that's one we definitely get out and hike and experience that rainforest. As I mentioned earlier, I was just in Chile photographing pumas, our mountain lion, same cat. It's possible there to photograph them on foot. And so we do a lot of hiking in Torres de Peña National Park in Chile. So that's definitely high up. People really want to get their heart rate up and do some hiking along with photography and wildlife viewing. Then that's a great destination.
What about Alaska? Tell us about your tours to Alaska.
Well, Alaska is another location that's close and easy to get to. And, you know, we have our own Serengeti right here in the United States, and that is Alaska. So there's nothing like the open spaces up there. I've been leading bear trips up there for over 10 years. And so this is a brown bear excursion where we're out, you know, on foot, hiking and photographing the feeding brown bears. They're feeding on salmon in August on the different rivers in Alaska. So it's another thrilling, large carnivore photography adventure. But once again, we're staying on a boat, and it's amazing food and catching our own halibut and king crab, and not much roughing it there either. I guess I'm getting older, Mimi, so I don't want to rough it either. So I like to go to destinations that we can, you know, have a nice place to stay and good food and enjoy each other's company and still get out and see wildlife.
Well, you're definitely a people person, so I can see how you would have fun leading these tours. For those of you who just tuned in, this is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, East County Magazine, and this is Mimi Pollack, and I'm talking to wildlife photographer Roy Tuft. Now, what would you say for when you take your people on these tours to Africa, Costa Rica, Alaska, Chile? Tell me 2 tips to be able to do successful wildlife photography.
2 tips. I think the first thing is patience. When we go out with wildlife, it's not like going to a studio or going to the zoo or where things are just going to perform for you. So, you know, I have to set expectations for my clients that we're going to extremely rich areas for wildlife, but there's still an element of being patient. The animals aren't there to please you or entertain you. We're just going in their environment. And obviously I'm taking people to very productive areas where we're going to see some great stuff, but, you know, just be happy to be there. And, you know, and that's my job, is to get you in the right spot at the right time and to have wonderful wilderness experiences.
Nice. Is there a website people can go to find out more information?
Sure. My website is toftphoto.com. So my last name, T-O-F as in Frank, T, photo, photo.com. And, you know, you can get on there. I have lots of different links to photography and wildlife. I actually have a tours and workshops page. So you want to get on there to see where I'm going, what I'm doing, and feel free to shoot me an email.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And if you would like more information about Roy, look for my article that's coming up in East County Magazine. This is Mimi Pollock of Animal Tales. Thank you very much.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
This is Hayden Parsley, on the road in Hucumba Hot Springs for East County Magazine. You can take a trip into California's past at the Desert View Tower, a quirky and whimsical relic of the past that is still open to the public here in San Diego's East County. Located just off Interstate 8 at the Incapa exit, the tower is poised on a rocky overlook surrounded by desert on all sides. Built in the 1920s by Bert Vaughn, a real estate tycoon who owned much of Hucumba, this 70-foot watchtower has become a tourist attraction and a local landmark on the outskirts of the small town known as Hucumba Hot Springs. Originally built to commemorate the area's rough pre-highway history, the tower houses a small museum filled with artifacts and oddities of California's history, including our region's Native American, Spanish, and pioneer past. The top floor of the tower is an observation deck, with a coin-fed telescope that provides a breathtaking view of Imperial Valley and the Anza Borrego Desert, though now somewhat marred by a wind farm. In 1950, a gift shop was added around the base of the tower. The shop still operates today and is filled with an eclectic mix of items such as geodes, gems and minerals, vintage postcards, historic and travel books on our region, arts and crafts items such as handmade Tecate tiles, onyx bookends, musical instruments, carved animal sculptures, and more. Roaming this area of the tower are the owner's many friendly dogs that add to the rustic charm of the location. You can also get a workout pumping a player piano while listening to old-time tunes. While I was there, the wind was gusting. It was a bit chilly and I wished I had a better coat when I reached the top. The owner says this is atypical though, and that it is warm and sunny most days. The proprietor, Ben Schultz, has many colorful stories on East County's history, culture, and colorful characters, having operated the site for many years. Boulder Park at the Desert View Tower was created in 1933 by an unemployed engineer, Merle Ratcliffe, who was out of work during the Great Depression. He sculpted reptiles and fanciful animals out of the huge stone boulders. I didn't get a chance to tour these, which will be an adventure for another time.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Green Scene Report. Just days before an April 14th court hearing filed by Citizens Oversight seeking to force removal of nuclear waste from storage along the ocean near the closed San Onofre nuclear power plant, Southern California Edison has agreed to enter into negotiations to move the nuclear storage elsewhere. Both parties have asked for a postponement of that hearing in order to pursue a settlement agreement. Attorneys Mike Aguirre and Maria Severson filed a stipulation on behalf of the plaintiff and Edison, joined by the state attorney general representing the California Coastal Commission. Aguirre states, "People of goodwill must come together and work to find a solution that is in the best interests of the people of the state of California." Tom Palmisano, the vice president and chief nuclear officer for Edison, the majority owner of the San Onofre facility, says, "We are hopeful that settlement discussions will permit the parties to reach a mutually agreeable solution." The suit was filed in November 2015 after the Coastal Commission granted Edison's permit to expand dry cast storage of used nuclear fuel at San Onofre. One-third of San Onofre's used fuel is currently in dry cask storage, and the remaining two-thirds is stored in steel-lined concrete pools. Edison had proposed to move the fuel from the pools into dry storage by 2019, where it would stay until an off-site storage facility becomes available, which could be indefinitely. Citizens Oversight, a watchdog group founded by El Cajon resident Ray Lutz, has contended that the location is unsafe because over 8 million people live within 50 miles of the site and because the canisters would be located just 100 feet from the ocean. Plaintiffs argued that the canisters could leak or be damaged by saltwater, tsunamis, or earthquakes since the site is in an active earthquake zone. Radioactive waste at the site will remain dangerous for thousands of years, and yet the dry cask storage units are only certified by federal regulators for 20 years. In addition to objections from environmentalists and area residents,
A prayer vigil was also recently held on the beach near the plant by Native American activists who hoped to see the waste removed as well. Edison and the State Coastal Commission tried to get Citizens Oversight's lawsuit dismissed as without merit, but Superior Court Judge Hayes declined to dismiss it and set the April 14th hearing that both sides have now agreed to postpone while they seek to negotiate a settlement and move the nuclear wastes elsewhere to avoid a trial. The reason that spent fuel rods from the nuclear plant at San Onofre have always been stored in cooling ponds on the site before the plant closed is because the federal government never approved a permanent national storage site. Now, however, the Trump administration's budget proposes $120 million toward a permanent nuclear waste repository at Yucca Mountain in Nevada, offering hope for a possible solution at last. Edison closed down the San Onofre nuclear generating stations in January 2012 after radiation leaks from steam generators were detected, announcing permanent closure of the facility in June 2013. After the wastes are removed and the site is fully decommissioned, the San Onofre property will be turned over to the U.S. Navy. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Rebecca Williamson with an update on the case of the missing El Cajon man, Elijah Diaz, known as Bear. Diaz went missing from his home on the night of August 29, 2015. He was 20 years old at the time and has not been heard from since then. Now, Discovery TV's investigation program will be airing a report on the disappearance of Bear Diaz. The episode is titled Every Mother's Son and will air on April 23rd at 7 p.m. Diaz is a diabetic. He had a serious foot injury at the time of his disappearance and was probably on crutches. His family was deeply concerned that he left with only enough insulin for a week and missed several doctor's appointments shortly after vanishing. A private investigator hired by the family called Diaz's disappearance suspicious, NBC 7 reported. A widescreen TV was missing from his room. Diaz left without his toothbrush, glasses, and cell phone charger. He was last seen wearing white baseball shorts and a gray sleeveless t-shirt. He is 5'10", weighed about 110 pounds when last seen, and has brown hair and brown eyes. Adele Weddle, with Bring Bear Home, a Facebook page dedicated to finding the missing young man, says, "We really need to spread the word as much as possible in hopes someone who sees the program will have information that could lead us to how Bear became missing." She hopes that the show will generate some leads in the mysterious disappearance of Elijah Bear Diaz. If you have information about this missing man, please contact the El Cajon Police Department at 619-579-3311. You can also send questions to bringbearhome@gmail.com or post comments on the Bring Bear Home Facebook page.
Ford's popular F-250 pickup trucks can shift into gear when parked and roll away, Ford Motor Company has announced. The company is recalling 52,000 of these trucks. The trucks in the recall were built in Kentucky between October 2015 and March 2017 and were sold across North America. Ford is offering free repairs on automatic transmissions in the recalled vehicles. In the meantime, owners of Ford F-250 6.2-liter model pickup trucks are advised to always use the parking brake to prevent parked vehicles from moving while in park. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.